It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on Fridays to end the week about some of the news that we want to touch on again or news that we didn't get to this week. Well, even though Hillary Clinton has surged in national polls against Donald Trump, a new poll out yesterday shows Clinton and Trump locked in a statistical tie here in Iowa. Our state is one of a handful of battleground states that will decide who moves into the White House next year, which explains why the two candidates are visiting our state this month. On Wednesday, Hillary Clinton held a campaign rally at Lincoln High School in Des Moines. This was Clinton's first trip to Iowa since she won the state's caucuses and secured her party's nomination. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters was there. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
I understand several prominent Democrats were on hand for this rally.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton was introduced by former U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and his wife, Ruth Harkin. There were a lot of Democrats in the audience that did not speak. Chuck Colver, the former Democratic governor, as well as Tom Miller, who is Iowa's attorney general and has endorsed her, one of just two statewide offices held by a Democrat. Neither of them spoke. Also in the audience was Frank County, the mayor of Des Moines. Now, these are nonpartisan positions, mayors are, but Mayor County is a Democrat, serves on President Obama's climate change task force of mayors. The most probably high office speaker was Matt McCoy, the state senator from Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. What messages did Hillary Clinton have for Iowans?
Well, it was a pretty short speech, about 15 minutes, and she was there to speak about her jobs plan. She's been talking about she'll make the biggest investment in good-paying jobs since World War II. She also, as she often does when she comes to the state, had some high praise for Iowa wind energy. Here's a little sample of that.
Anybody who says to me, well, you know, we can't really transition to clean, renewable energy, I ask them, have you been to Iowa lately? You already get a third of your electricity from wind.
And she also had high praise for union workers. She said that labor unions have dwindled and she wants to have more stronger labor. Of course, this was also the day after Donald Trump made that comment that we have to quote verbatim, where he said, nothing you can do, folks, regarding Clinton picking judges if elected president. Although the Second Amendment people, quote, maybe there is. And Clinton said at this Des Moines rally as well that if you're running for president, words can have tremendous consequences. Here's how she first responded to those comments made by Donald Trump.
And now his casual inciting of violence. Every single one of these incidents shows us that Donald Trump simply does not have the temperament to be president and commander-in-chief of the United States.
And Ben, of course, Trump's campaign had come back and said that he was calling for political unification among fans of the Second Amendment.
And it's so interesting how fast things are moving at this point in the election cycle, especially propelled by Donald Trump's controversial remarks. Since that one at the beginning of the week, we had in the last couple of days Donald Trump repeatedly saying Barack Obama was literally the founder of ISIS and that Clinton was its co-founder. Now something, we wake up to the news today that he, after repeatedly saying he meant it literally, he says now it was meant sarcastically. So talk a little bit about, you've covered both Trump and Clinton in their separate rallies, their campaign rallies. What is the difference there of a feeling, of an atmosphere, of the type of people who come to these rallies and what they're looking for?
I was at the Cedar Rapids event a couple weeks ago. This was on the night that Hillary Clinton accepted the nomination for her party in Philadelphia. Donald Trump was speaking in Cedar Rapids. This was his first swing through the state since securing the Republican nomination. And it's been interesting to me now that it's been a few months removed from the caucuses. You know, a year ago, Donald Trump was in a very crowded group of Republican candidates. Something like 17 of them were running. And it's interesting now to go to the Trump rallies and realize that this is the party's nominee. You know, the Cedar Rapids event, people were coming out of that. There were protesters on the other side of the street in downtown Cedar Rapids. And there was quite a clash between those that were leaving the rally and those that were on the other side of the street. There was some shouting from the Trump supporters leaving. There was just a lot of confrontation happening. And the Des Moines event a couple weeks, well, I guess it was just last week that was held in Des Moines. It was a much more low-key outside of the arena in downtown Des Moines. Also, comparatively here, too, Hillary Clinton was speaking at a high school in Des Moines in a more residential area. There were some protesters outside, including some Bernie Sanders people who were protesting it as well, some fans of him in the election. But, you know, high school is a little off the beaten path. And then it also gives an idea of education. She's in a high school gym. There are the banners that are up there. School's not quite in session. She talks a lot about education in her speeches. And so that's a contrast to the Donald Trump rallies that have happened so far that have been in more convention hall settings.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Clay, before we end this conversation, back to the poll I mentioned at the outset here. This is a Suffolk University poll conducted a few days ago, August 8th through the 10th, 500 Iowa voters who said they were either very likely or somewhat likely to vote in November's general election, a margin of error plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. So 1 percentage point separating the two, Clinton 40%, Trump 41%. So it's statistically a dead heat, a tie here. I wonder if you had any thoughts about why, despite the national polls, which show a very large swing toward Clinton, and despite Republican leaders say is Donald Trump's self-destructive comments, Iowa remains stubbornly close when we look at this poll.
Yeah, I don't want to speculate too much, but I guess I'd come at it in a couple ways. Number one, you know, we were talking about all the Democrats that were at this event, and a lot of them that were prominent didn't speak ahead of time. What's interesting when you contrast that to the Republican side, at least in the state, is you have a lot of buy-in from the governor, from the chair of the Republican Party, from both Iowa's U.S. Senators, Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley. I know that they are fully supportive of Donald Trump being the president, which, you know, there's not a lot of party individuals for the Democrats that are in elected offices. So maybe that is having some kind of effect. I would also point to just at how close the Iowa caucuses were on the Democratic side when you had Hillary Clinton just squeezed out a victory in the caucuses over Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I have to wonder if there are a lot of Sanders fans who maybe are bitter or maybe won't vote in the election. So, again, don't want to speculate too much, but those are two things that have crossed my mind as I've been covering both campaigns.
Okay, Clay Masters, I'm sure there'll be plenty of other conversations. After all, we have, what, 86, 87 days left?
There are less, how do we want to put this? There are now more counties in Iowa than there are days until the election.
Okay.
An amazing thing to say.
I will think about that the entire day and and wonder what it really means, Clay. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, thanks.
My pleasure, thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week. That's what we love to do on News Buzz Fridays. The Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines is preparing for the birth of its first baby rhinoceros. Joining us to talk about the big delivery to come, Dr. June Olds, senior veterinarian at Blank Park Zoo, also clinician of zoo animal medicine at Iowa State University, and Lou Keeley, large mammal area supervisor at the Blank Park Zoo. Lou and Dr. Olds, welcome to our studio and our program.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Dr. Olds, tell us about the mother. Her name, Ayana? Did I get that right?
It's Ayana.
Ayana, tell us about her. When did you find out she was expecting?
So we were hoping Ayana was pregnant for quite some time, but we confirmed her pregnancy in April. We were doing a lot of hormonal testing, and it indicated that she was, but we finally were able to confirm the pregnancy by ultrasound in April.
Mm-hmm. When is the due date?
We are anticipating sometime late this fall. We're not really specifying a date at this time, but we think, towards November.
Mm-hmm. And so their period, their what gestation period, is longer than for humans.
Yeah, 16 months is the gestation. So, and that's a range of days. So it depends on the animal, the individual animal, and the place that they're born, but about 16 months.
Mm-hmm. Lou, tell us a little bit more specifically about this species. This is a black rhino, and they're quite rare.
That's correct, Ben. So in the wild, there's about 5,000 left. And like most rhinoceros species nowadays, they're coming under tremendous pressure from poaching. So they'll get poached for their horns, which will be sent to kind of Southeast Asia markets where they use them for traditional medicine. Or it's kind of a status symbol now because it's so expensive. It's worth more than its weight in gold.
Mm-hmm. So in the wild, about 5,000 in captivity, such as at the Blank Park Zoo, about how many?
So in North America, there's currently 60, and so this pregnancy is going to be especially important. There hasn't been a black rhino birth in North America since May 2014, so that's quite a long time to go between births.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Olds, tell us a little bit about how she's doing this far into her pregnancy. How big of an animal are we talking about, first of all, when you talk about your patient here?
So Ayana is about, what, 1,600 kilos?
1,600.
Where are we at?
1,600 kilos.
1,250
kilos. I'm sorry, 1,250 kilos. So she is a large animal.
She's like 3,000 pounds now.
Right.
Okay.
And she has been steadily gaining weight. Her appetite has been good. Her attitude has been good. So she's had a really uneventful pregnancy so far, and that's exactly the way we want it to be. So she's been very happy and doing very well.
Mm-hmm. How do you examine her?
We have a magnificent training program at the Blank Park Zoo, and Lou's team especially is very good at training their animals. And so she comes over every day to be weighed and for various training behaviors. So she's trained for ultrasound. She's trained for blood collection. We get to examine her every day, and she's reached a stage of pregnancy now where we can actually see the fetus moving and kicking, and so that's great too.
Mm-hmm.
But she's very compliant and very easygoing animal, so we get to examine her closely.
Lou, did you have the feeling you know Ayana like one would know a dog, for instance? Is the temperament similar? I'm just trying to get a sense of what this animal is like.
Yeah, Ben, so we often compare them to dogs. So, I mean, being born and raised in a zoo, they're very comfortable being around people. And I think they have a bad rap with having that aggressive persona, which they kind of get in the wild, where it's charge first, ask questions later.
Or from Disney.
Those folks over there.
Charge!
No, but they love, both of our rhinos love coming up and being pet, and they love this interaction. Like Dr. Olds was saying, they're very good with training because they love being around us, and two, they love food. So anything they can do to get food, they'll...
What kind of food?
So for training, we'll use produce, so apples, carrots, sweet potatoes. They love the sweeter things. So,
mm-hmm. So they're not carnivores?
Not carnivores, pure herbivores. So they're browsers in the wild. They like shrubs and trees. So
They have to eat a lot to keep that weight up, I imagine.
Yeah, 40 to 50 pounds of food per day. So that's mostly hay, and they kind of get a specialized grain pellet as well to round out their diet.
Mm-hmm. Lou, what are the challenges breeding and raising animals in captivity, especially such a large one as a 3,000-pound black rhino?
So the problems we've had recently in zoos, they can get somewhat aggressive towards each other, males and females, when you do put them together for the first time, kind of a first date type thing. So we've been lucky here at the zoo. We got them when they were both 2 years old, and these guys can live into their 40s. So they're still youngsters yet. They're only 5 years old. So right away, Ben, we would kind of put them next to one another. We call them howdies, where they could see each other, smell each other, but not totally be in the same space as one another.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, over the years, they've gotten to know each other, their smells, how they look, what sounds they make. And then gradually we start putting them together for short periods of time, then lengthening the sessions they are together. So they get to know each other very well, which leads to little or no aggression that we see from them. So they do spar from time to time still, but overall they don't really get into it as much as they have the potential to.
Mm-hmm. And obviously Ayana had found the right chemistry in a partner there become impregnated there. And tell us, Dr. Olds, what excites you most regarding the upcoming birth? What preparations are you making? What will be the challenges when the big day arrives?
So we are very hopeful that everything is going to go exactly as planned, and nature, will find a way, and everything will be smooth. But we're doing some contingency planning. Usually, rhinos don't have problems giving birth, but there's the potential for what's called a dystocia or a breech birth. So we're going to have plans in place to intervene if it's necessary. We have the facility is brand new, and so it's wired technologically, so we can monitor these animals remotely. So there's remote cameras, and we'll be able to check them 24/7. So we won't have to be in the space to watch her and watch the birth. So we'll be able to observe from outside, be able to see if there's a problem, and know when we have to do an intervention. And we don't want to cause any undue stress to her by watching her physically in the room. So we're going to set up an ability to watch her 24 hours a day when we think the birth is near. And then we'll be able to record the birth and see if there's any issues. And then we'll be able to also record the interactions between the infant and Ayana and make sure that she's appropriately caring for it, that it's getting up and nursing appropriately. But we'll have plans all the way along the way. So if it's not nursing, if it's having difficulties rising, of what our next steps will be and if we'll have to do any intervention. But hopefully, we're all planning that we won't have to intervene.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully a great birth, a natural birth, and we have a nice calf. Do you call them a calf?
Yeah, you do call them a calf. Mm-hmm. And they're adorable when they're born. So, yes.
Do they have a horn?
No, the horn grows in later.
Okay. Well, intervention. You keep saying intervention. Yeah. I have to ask, in worst case scenario, when people growing up on farms with cattle know sometimes, there has to be an intervention. Right. What is the form of the intervention if Ayana would have problems during birth?
Well, it depends on the situation and what her status is. She is trained to get into what's called a chute, and that's where we load her or where we weigh her. And so it's possible that if she would voluntarily get into the chute and allow us to help her, we might be able to do things just naturally that way and just maybe give her a little help. If she is in a situation where she's in distress, then we might have to intervene by using some medications, some drugs to sedate her and then help get the calf out. And again, that would, we would go a stepwise protocol. If this, then this. But we would hope to get through this without having to use any medications.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, before we have to say goodbye, any names being discussed for the baby? Do you even know the sex of the newborn?
I'm hoping, for me, and people say I'm kind of vain, but if it's a female, Lou, if it's a male, Lou. But these guys are so cute, and, once we know the calf's doing great with mom, we'll try to get them out as soon as the public can go out and see them, and I think that's one of the biggest reasons we have animals and rhinos in zoos, so people can come see how just awesome, magnificent these animals are, and, take their little steps, whether donating to conservation charities, to do their part to help save these animals in the wild.
Okay. Lou Keeley and Dr. June Olds of the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines expecting a baby rhino, their first baby rhino born at the Blank Park Zoo. That due date again?
We're going to shoot for late fall.
Late fall. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks to both of you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What did you do this summer? That'll be a question behind many classroom discussions, also essays, of course, when students return to school in a few weeks' time. Craig Hemseth is someone who will certainly have a lot to talk about when he returns to his classroom in LaPorte City. Craig teaches biology, anatomy, and environmental science at Union High School in LaPorte City. He's also the recipient of a National Geographic and Lindblad Expeditions Grosvenor Teacher Fellowship. I don't know if I got that right, Craig. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
You took a journey as part of this fellowship. Where did the journey in June take you?
So myself and another teacher from outside of Seattle, Washington, we got to spend a week on the ship called the National Geographic Explorer, touring around the Svalbard Archipelago.
Tell us where that is.
It's about a three-hour flight straight north of Norway, and the main city there lies at 78 degrees north, so we were within a few hundred miles of the North Pole.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the world's northernmost inhabited areas. What was your focus while you were there?
Really, the big goal is just sort of exploring, just go where there's good weather and good ice conditions and look for polar bears, look for whales, other wildlife that we can find along the way.
Mm-hmm. So what wildlife did you end up seeing?
Well, about an hour after we got onto the ship, we actually spotted a blue whale maybe 60, 75 feet away from us, which is kind of a rare sighting for Svalbard. And it kept going from there. We got to see groups of walruses pulled up on the beach. I think we saw in total about 24 polar bears along the sea ice, and lots of whales, lots of birds, some Arctic fox, about everything they have to offer, I think.
I understand you also came across some old settlements of past explorers.
Yeah, we stopped and visited a couple of like old trappers' cabins when polar bear trapping was allowed, and some of the old original Russian settlements from like the late 1700s, early 1800s. We got to visit and sort of explore around those.
Mm-hmm. So when you come back to the classroom, and I'm sure you're well into preparation for the school year, what part of this trip do you want to emphasize to your students at Union High School in La Porte City?
I hope through just all the photographs and videos and experts that I talked to when we were there that hopefully I can bring back how sort of the biological rules of Svalbard and how they're the same plants and animals, they play by the same rules, that they need energy, they need food, they, you know, have competition, those kinds of things, and be able to show that we can learn about stuff here, we can learn about stuff there, and the biology doesn't change, just the species.
Mm-hmm. Is the Svalbard archipelago showing any signs of global climate change?
That is one of, on the ship there are several naturalists that are experts in Arctic biology, and one of the things I kept pointing out is how much it's changed, and a couple of the naturalists have been up there for, you know, 30-plus years, and we would go into some fjord, and they'd talk about how just 10 or 15 years ago, the glacier was 5-6 miles out further down the fjord, and here we can go clear up, and it's, you know, melted that much in a really short amount of time.
So very quickly, we only have 30 seconds left. How do you deliver that news, or how do you talk about that with students when polar bears, so much of this is a little bit gloomy for polar bears and the Arctic species?
Hopefully it can just relate back to them that sometimes it is doom and gloom, but biology, the species up there, they'll find a way, and nothing lasts forever, and it may look a little different, may have a few different species, but life will go on, I guess.
Okay. Craig Hemseth, thank you very much. A teacher at Union High School in La Porte City. Great to have you back in the Iowa warmth during August, Craig.
Yeah, it was a shock to get home.
All right. Craig Hemseth of Union High School in La Porte City. When we come back, we'll talk about the promise of urban farming, a new gym in Orange City in northwest Iowa designed for autistic kids, and research on self-destructing batteries. Yes, self-destructing batteries, what they are and why we need them, that's still to come. I'm Ben Kiefer, a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of our program, Short Conversations to End the Week. Coming up in a little bit, we'll talk about a new gymnasium designed. It's in Orange City, Iowa, designed with autistic children in mind. Also, toward the end of the program, self-destructing batteries. What they are, and why in the heck you would ever need a self-destructing battery. But first, urban farms and gardens are popping up in cities all over the country. They're often touted as the key to a sustainable lifestyle, creating healthy, vibrant communities, and promoting economic development at the same time. However, a new study by the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future says urban agriculture advocates need to be careful about overselling the benefits of urban farms and gardens. Joining me to talk about it, someone who's reported on this for Harvest Public Media, Suzanne Hogan. Hello, Suzanne.
Hello.
Before we talk to you a little bit more about the report and your report on this, tell us, what is meant by urban farming, gardening?
Well, part of that, it means a lot of things. It can be everything from, you know, a community garden space in the middle of an inner city. It could be just a couple plants in front of a school. There's such a wide spectrum of what it means. And in Kansas City, I mean, there's a lot of green space, a lot of vacant lands that have been turned into places where people are growing food. So it's a really large spectrum of things.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about an urban farmer that you met for this story.
Dre Taylor is somebody that I met. He's with Nile Valley Aquaponics. It was part of this urban-grown tour that Kansas City, Cultivate KC, put on in Kansas City earlier this summer. And he is trying to basically mentor a lot of children in the neighborhood of where he started this aquaponic farm. And it's really taking off. I mean, he has some work still to get it on the ground, but he has kids coming 2 times a week to help him work on the vegetables that they're growing. And then he also has them going out to farmers markets and learning a lot of entrepreneurial skills. So he's really an amazing guy that I met along the way.
Mm-hmm. So what does his garden or his farm look like? We have the peak of the growing season right now.
Well, so he is actually going to be raising fish. I don't know a whole lot about aquaponics. This is something that was really new for me. But he's basically in the middle of a food desert. They're hoping to basically cultivate 10,000 pounds within a year. And this is still getting off the ground, but they're trying to create 70,000 pounds of chemical-free vegetables and then 30,000 pounds of naturally fed tilapia. So it's still getting going, but part of that has been getting engaged with the community around him and also getting a lot of the kids in the neighborhood to help him out.
Mm-hmm. That sounds exciting. Let's play a little bit of your conversation that you had with Dre Taylor in Kansas City and talking to him about his expectations.
When you first kind of had this idea and you would maybe talk to friends or things like that, were people kind of like, what? Or like, I mean, what was kind of the reaction?
Yeah, I mean, you said you're going to build a greenhouse in the middle of the hood. You know, it's like, what are you doing? Why are you going to do it there? People don't understand how aquaponics work. It's like foreign, so they don't really understand the concept until they see it. So I just knew I had to get it built, and they'll see it as it goes up.
So why do you think it's important to have things like this within urban areas in Kansas City?
Because we're in a food desert. There's a high unemployment rate, and so it's some crime. And so this is a crime. It's a way to prevent crime from happening. It's a way to address a lot of health issues that we have in the community. It's a way to address a lot of different things, a lot of different topics, global warming, reducing our carbon footprint, alternative energy with solar and wind. So it hits a lot of different topics that a lot of people talk about. And so I think this is imperative that we do something like this anywhere, not just in the urban core, but everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a worthy goal, a worthy project there. I have to ask you, Suzanne Hogan, how is this being financed?
Well, he's going through a lot of grant writing processes. He's basically, the Nile Valley Aquaponics is a combination of two other nonprofits in Kansas City that have combined together to try to get this off the ground. And they still have a lot of work to do. Part of the reason this didn't make it in the actual final story is because it is such a story in itself, and there's so much more to be told there.
Mm-hmm.
He's hoping to have it off the ground within a month or so.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the new study by John Hopkins Center for Livable Future. Tell us more about the takeaways from that.
Well, so I talked to Rachel Santo, one of the co-authors, and I think one of the big things is you hear urban agriculture, and like I said earlier, it is such a wide spectrum of things. And how do you measure how things are doing like that? How do you measure quantifiable and unquantifiable things? What Rachel Santo would say is that really where urban agriculture seems to have a lot of benefit is in these sociocultural ways that it builds community. But some of the places where it falls short are some of the more economic side, you know, promising jobs, promising all these things that are going to better the community as a whole. And that's just such a huge, it's a tall order.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when we look to the future, I'm just trying to help us imagine what some of the urban centers may be transformed into, or what the advocates are hoping they'll be transformed into in, you know, a few years' time.
It sounds like all the advocates are just saying that they want more studies like this, actually, because this isn't something that has been really researched fully in a way that people can really fully understand what the bigger takeaways can be. I mean, I feel like everybody who's involved in the movement for urban agriculture is saying that they really just want to normalize food production. When you see people growing vegetables in their front yard, when you see a bigger operation, when you see a farmer's market, it makes people think about where their food is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And of course, in an urban environment, how much nicer is it to walk through your neighborhood and instead of an empty lot or a rundown house, you see a garden vegetable?
Right, right. It's something that you think, oh, wow, yeah, that tomato looks good. I'd like to eat that. But there's a lot of work that goes involved to make that happen. And so it's learning about the process of that and normalizing the idea that, oh, I could put this plant in my front yard and it might produce some food for me.
Right. Okay, Suzanne Hogan, thanks for the reporting and thanks for this conversation. Suzanne Hogan of Harvest Public Media talking about urban agriculture. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, let me mention this, a nice program coming up Monday after the weekend. Political journalist Ari Berman will join us. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. In the first half, we'll talk with Ari. Then in the second half, presidential historian Tim Walch on books the next president should read to prepare for the Oval Office. And you'll be able to chip in with your suggestions. So there's the question you can think about over the weekend, or perhaps you can tweet us at IPR Talk now if you have a book in mind, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Give us a book title. Give us an author the next president should read in order to prepare for the Oval Office. We'll talk about that Monday with presidential historian Tim Walch. Let's finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's part of a relatively new field of study, and it's called transient electronics. These transient devices could perform a variety of functions until exposure to light or heat or liquid triggers their self-destruction. Reza Montazami is with us, assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University and affiliate scientist with the Ames Laboratory. Good afternoon to you, Reza.
Hi, Ben. Great to join the program.
So in what situations would a self-destructing battery come in handy?
Well, the self-destructing battery must be implemented with a self-destructing device. You don't want a self-destructing battery on a non-self-destructing device because it wouldn't make much sense. But assuming that the whole system is transient or self-destructing, the potential applications are in hardware security and identity and technology protection. And that can range from items in biomedical devices, environmental monitoring devices, military surveillance devices, or basically any place that you may want to remove your footprint and don't want to have your identity, your information, or your technology to be recovered by people whom you don't want to have that information.
Mm-hmm. Reza, tell us about the battery that you and your team are working on now. I understand you've been working on it for several years.
Yes, the battery project in my team, the lithium battery project started about 4 years ago, but then the transient battery project started about roughly 3 years ago, since August of 2013. The battery is self-destructing in about 30 minutes when it's exposed to water or similar solutions, and that similar solution can be anything, almost anything that is water-based if the solution is not too saturated. And the battery is consisted of relatively common battery material. So the battery that you have on your cell phone or other lithium-ion batteries pretty much have the same components. But what we did, we took these components because they are very well studied over the past decades, and their performance is optimized. The chemistry or the electrochemistry of them is optimized. So we used those systems, and then we tried to make them transient. So we didn't want to we didn't want to reinvent the chemistry of a battery. So we used the existing mm-hmm. chemistry of a battery, and then we tweaked those chemicals, those active materials, and try to make them transient. And we achieve a 2.5 volt potential difference between the electrodes, which is comparable to what an ordinary lithium iron battery delivers.
Mm-hmm. And you say these have potential applications for being put in people's bodies to power various devices?
This particular transient electronics and transient batteries in general, yes. But this particular one, since it has lithium in it, it's not suitable to be implanted inside the body. This is more for applications that are in the environment or non-biological applications. It can be used for epidermal electronics, which are placed on the skin, but I don't think it would be a good idea to implant it inside the biological system.
You mentioned something interesting, that it would be in a case where you wouldn't want to have a footprint. So can you give me a specific case that this might have an application for? Is this perhaps also in espionage?
Sure. Let me give you an example in environmental monitoring sensors. Let's say you want to measure soil humidity in some forest in Brazil. You don't want to send people there. You don't want to disturb the environment. You don't want to disturb the nature. So you can just fly over, drop these sensors, and they do their job. So they collect the information, they transmit the data. Actually, we tested an antenna that can transmit data about 2 years ago. So you have these sensors there. They collect the information, they transmit the data, and then after the first or second rain, depending on, of course, how much rain is pouring, after the first or second rain, your sensor is dissolved and is not there anymore.
Mm-hmm. So in developing these self-destructing batteries, the one you're working on, you and your team have faced, what have been the chief challenges that you've been trying to work through?
Well, the most challenging aspect of the work was working with the conventional battery material, because there are many electrical devices, especially those based on semiconductors like transistors. They have a operation threshold voltage. So if the voltage drops under some particular potential, the device doesn't work. So most of the electronics that are in the market have these semiconductors in them. So having a battery that delivers, say, like 1 volt for a long period of time, it may have many applications, but is not suitable to power conventional electronics. So our main challenge was to make something that can deliver a high enough potential or high enough voltage that is suitable to operate an ordinary electronic. So then there is less focus on modifying the electronic circuit. So you can use the existing circuits, and then the battery is already meeting the standard. So the voltage was one of the main challenges.
Okay. Reza Montazami, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Iowa State University, also affiliate scientist with the Ames Laboratory, talking about his research group's work on developing a working battery that self-destructs in water. Reza, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we go to Orange City in northwest Iowa, where a new gymnasium is about to open that's been designed with autistic children in mind. Joining us to talk about it, Rachel Brunsting, owner of the soon-to-open We Rock the Spectrum facility. And Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Now, this has something to do with your son. Your son is on the autistic spectrum. What is his name?
He is. His name is Kyan.
Kyan. And yes. He's 9 years old?
Yes, he is. Yep.
Okay, so how did this project start?
So I last winter, in the midst of all the cold and bundled up and going through cabin fever, decided that I wanted to find some place that I could bring him that wouldn't overstimulate him. And so I began just Googling even local places and couldn't really find that. And so I began the search for bringing something to our area that was maybe somewhere else. So
mm-hmm.
I found We Rock the Spectrum on the Internet and began conversations with them.
Right. We Rock the Spectrum, referring, of course, to the spectrum of autism. For those not acquainted with autism, how do you describe it? I'm sure you have to describe it many times.
Yeah, the thing with autism is that it is a spectrum, and so each child is authentic and unique in their own way of having autism. And so things that are associated with autism are like sensory issues. So either they seek sensory, so they like to be touched, they like to feel things, or that they are withdrawn from sensory. They don't like to be touched. The tags on their clothes bother them. Sunlight bothers them. Even, you know, the materials that are their clothes are made of, shoes, anything that touches them bothers them. And then also the main other one is like social skills. Some usually children on the spectrum have a hard time with eye contact and using appropriate social skills and are usually pretty self-centered, and they don't even know that, but can coexist in their own environment without any other connections and are just fine that way.
I understand the opening is coming up on August 20th. Tell us, how is this gym, this gymnasium, different than a typical gymnasium? You said it's designed not to overstimulate?
Right, yeah. So the equipment is specifically designed to work with many of the sensory processing issues that children have on the spectrum while providing the children with a sensory diet necessary for improved learning and then their neurological development. Mm-hmm. So, like, the zip line helps the children with their vestibular sensations and gives them sensory feedback while allowing them to better develop upper arm and core strength.
So that zip line does what in plain language? You go on the zip line and it makes sounds?
No. So they hold on with their arms, and so it's building their muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also gives them the sensation of going down. So it is the perception around them.
Mm-hmm. And this equipment, these things in this gymnasium have been tested. We know that autistic kids like these and can learn and develop with these?
Yeah, you know, and the thing is that the equipment is intentionally picked out to help the development of children, but all children can come and play. And that's really the whole idea of it, too, is that you can mix neurological children with atypical children, with all sorts of children, and they're each getting what they need. And so the children with sensory processing or with autism or any other trauma can come and get the input that they need, while the other kids that necessarily don't need that just have fun.
Mm-hmm. So your son, Kyan, is he excited? Has he been to what is being developed there?
He has not. So the closest one to us is Kansas City, and we haven't made that trip. But he is awfully excited. Our gym is different than the other gyms that have been put up in the fact that it is on our property. So we are putting up a gym. It's a mile west of Warren City, and it's the first We Rock the Spectrum from the ground up. And so he has been very hands-on. He has put the trampoline together for us, and he's put a climber together, and he is out there cleaning the floor for me today. So, yes, he is very excited about what is happening in our backyard.
And you've been alerting parents and kids in the area who may be dealing with autism that this is the place to come, huh?
You betcha. I am part of an autism support group, and so I have made them aware, and then there is a center in Sioux City that we've been in connection with, and then just some other therapists locally.
Mm-hmm. Now, Orange City, the location just outside of Orange City on your property will be, I understand, the first We Rock facility, not in an urban community. So that's a challenge, right? You want to draw people from out of town too, right?
Right, yep. So it's going to be a really big challenge for us, but you know, we feel like this area is got a big deficit of the things that children with autism and other special needs need, and so we thought, what better way to bring it? And, you know, yeah, we hope that we draw from a wide variety, but for us, if one child benefits, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. How many kids around the area potentially might want to come to visit We Rock the Spectrum?
Well, I hope all of them. It is a gym for all kids, and so all kids can have fun. And even, you know, it's a place for children to play. So, you know, if there is one family member that is unable to handle, let's say, a football game, so then usually the whole family doesn't go, or they end up going separate ways.
Right.
Where this is a place that the whole family could come and everybody could have fun. Statistics currently say, I think it's 1 in 66 kids have autism. 1 in 8 kids have sensory processing issues. And so, you know, there's a wide variety of children that will be able to benefit from the facility that we have.
Okay, we have to go. Rachel Brunstein, thank you very much for joining us. Owner of the soon-to-open We Rock the Spectrum. Rachel, very quickly, how do people find out more on the web?
At WeRockTheSpectrumOrangeCity.com.
Okay, thanks very much, Rachel. Good luck with the opening.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. We want to have a big thanks to our intern who is leaving today, Graham Bly. You've been a great summer intern. Thanks for all the hard work, and good luck to you. Also, thanks to John Pemble today in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.